This broadcast of the PJC Media Network seeks to present wholesome, thought-provoking, and entertaining content. However, the views expressed by the hosts of PJC Media are theirs and theirs alone. They do not reflect the views of this network or its affiliates. Please utilize listener discretion.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White Show. Each week, we feature different topics concerning issues that sometimes can be difficult to talk about. These issues concern children and adults who may be autistic, have Asperger's, or have mental disorders of any kind. We will discuss law enforcement and how they interact with these persons. Now, let's start the show.
All right. Welcome to another Friday episode of the Let's Talk About It with Jenny White Show. I'm your host, Maceo Coleman, and I'm accompanied by the hostess with the mostest, Miss Jenny White. How are you today?
I'm fine.
Great. TGIF?
Oh, yes. How about you? You okay?
Yeah, I'm doing great over here. It's been a rainy day all day, so
yep.
A little partly cloudy and overcast, but no problems. Thankful and grateful.
All right. I know that's right.
Yeah, so, you know, we're going to be talking about some interesting topics today. I'm going to bounce around to a few different things, and I'm going to have everybody
Something that we didn't talk about last week.
Yeah, last week we had technical difficulties, so we weren't able to talk about the show, the meeting at Jekyll Island, but we're going to talk about it today and just kind of give people an idea of a monetary system and how things got started and why we pay taxes and talk about the central banks and a lot of the monetary systems. So I think today is going to be a real educational moment. It's going to give people an opportunity to ask a lot of questions in regards to the establishment of the Federal Reserve and some of these central banks. And I think people have a better understanding of why they're paying taxes and where their taxes are going. So without further ado, I see we've got some other people that have joined us. So, again, welcome to the Jenny White Show. I'm your host, Maceo Coleman, and joined by the hostess with the mostest, Ms. Jenny White. And we're going to be talking about the meeting at Jekyll Island, which was held in 1910. There was a secret gathering at a secluded island. Oh, Jesus Christ. Who is that? Let's put them on mute. There's a lot of noise. If you want to join back in and say something, push the one and raise your hand.
I know that's right.
Okay. And tell them kids, be quiet.
Holy moly, that man.
Right. All right. Like we were saying, the meeting at Jekyll Island was a secret gathering at a secluded island off the coast of Georgia in 1910, which laid the foundations for the Federal Reserve System as we know it today. So like many Americans, these men were concerned with financial panics, which had disrupted economic activity in the United States periodically during the 19th century. The meeting and its purpose were closely guarded secrets, and the participants did not admit that the meeting had even occurred until the 1930s. This group of six men called themselves First Name Club.
First Name Club.
All right, so.
I'm sorry.
We're gonna tell you how these cats get down. What'd you say?
Can you repeat that name? And they were called what?
The First Name Club. They all just went by their first names.
Okay,
so people
thank you.
So Yeah, so when they attended this meeting, people wouldn't know who they were. So
okay.
A secret gathering at a secluded island off the coast of Georgia in 1910 laid the foundations for the Federal Reserve System. In November 1910, six men, Nelson Aldrich, A. Piatt Andrew, Henry Davidson, Arthur Shelton, Frank Vanderlip, and Paul Warburg met at the Jekyll Island Club off the coast of Georgia to write a plan to reform the nation's banking system. Now, the meeting and its purpose were closely guarded secrets, and the participants did not admit that the meeting occurred until the 1930s. But the plan written on Jekyll Island laid a foundation for what would eventually be the Federal Reserve System. They felt there was a need for reform. So at the time, the men who met on Jekyll Island believed the banking system suffered from serious problems. The Jekyll Island participants' views on this issue are well known. Since before and after their conclave, several spoke publicly and others published extensively on the topic. Collectively, they encapsulated their concerns in the plan they wrote on Jekyll Island and in the reports of the National Monetary Commission. Like many Americans, these men were concerned with financial panics, which had disrupted economic activity in the United States periodically during the 19th century. Nationwide panics occurred on average every 15 years. These panics forced financial institutions to suspend operations, triggering long and deep recessions. American banks held large required reserves of cash, but these reserves were scattered throughout the nation, held in the vaults of thousands of banks or as deposits in financial institutions and designated reserve and central reserve cities. So during crises, they became frozen in place, preventing them from being used to alleviate the situation. So during booms, banks' excess reserves tended to flow toward big cities, especially New York, where bankers invested them in call loans, which were loans repayable on demand to brokers. The brokers, in turn, loaned the funds to investors speculating in equity markets whose stock purchases served as collateral for the transactions. This American system made bank reserves immobile and equity markets volatile, a recipe for financial instability. Now, in Europe, in contrast, bankers invested much of their portfolio in short-term loans to merchants and manufacturers. This commercial paper directly financed commerce and industry while providing banks with assets that they could quickly convert to cash during a crisis. These loans remained liquid for several reasons. First, borrowers paid financial institutions, typically banks, with which they had long-standing relationships to guarantee repayment in case the borrowers could not meet their financial obligations. Second, the loans funded merchandise in the process of production and sale, and that merchandise served as collateral should borrowers default. So if you're making clothes, you can't pay your bills, your clothes is your collateral. Now, the Jekyll Island participants also worried about the inelastic supply of currency in the United States. The value of the dollar was linked to gold, and the quantity of currency available was linked to the supply of a special series of federal government bonds. The supply of currency neither expanded nor contracted with seasonal changes in demands for cash, such as the fall harvest or the holiday shopping seasons, causing interest rates to vary substantially from 1 month to the next. The inelastic supply of currency and limited supplies of gold also contributed to long and painful deflations. Not inflation, but deflations. Furthermore, Jekyll Island participants believed that an array of antiquated arrangements impeded America's financial and economic progress. For example, American banks could not operate overseas. Thus, American merchants had to finance imports and exports through financial houses in Europe, principally London. American banks also struggled to collectively clear checks outside the boundaries of a single city. This increased cost of intercity and interstate commerce and required risky and expensive remittances of cash over long distances. So in an article published in the New York Times in 1907, Paul Warburg, a successful German-born financier who was a partner at the investment bank Kuhn, Loeb & Company, and widely regarded as an expert on the banking systems in the United States and Europe, wrote that the United States financial system was at about the same point that had been reached by Europe at the times of the Medicis and by Asia, in all likelihood at the time of Hammurabi. And that's what Warburg wrote in 1907. Just months after Warburg wrote those words, the country was struck by the panic of 1907. The panic galvanized the U.S. Congress, particularly Republican Senator Nelson Aldrich, the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. In 1908, which was the year my aunt Charlie Mae Wilson was born, Aldrich sponsored a bill with Republican Representative Edward Vreeland that, among other things, created the National Monetary Commission to study reforms to the financial system. Aldrich quickly hired several advisors to the commission, including Henry Davison, a partner at J.P. Morgan, and A. Piet Andrew, an economics professor at Harvard University. So over the next 2 years, they studied banking and financial systems extensively and visited Europe to meet with bankers and central bankers. The duck hunt. So by the fall of 1910, Aldrich was persuaded of the necessity of a central bank for the United States. He figured, you know, the United States needs a central bank. So with Congress ready to begin meeting in just a few weeks, Aldrich, most likely at Davison's suggestion, decided to convene a small group to help him synthesize all he had learned and write down a proposal to establish a central bank. All right, now don't forget who he is. Aldrich is the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. All right, so the group included Aldrich, his private secretary Arthur Shelton, Davison, Andrew, who by 1910 had been appointed assistant treasury secretary, Frank Vanderlip, president of National City Bank and a former treasury official, and Warburg, a member of the exclusive Jekyll Island Club, most likely J.P. Morgan, arranged for the group to use the club's facilities. Founded in 1886, the club's membership boasted elites such as Morgan, Marshall Fields, which is Hudson's, Macy's, and William Kissam, Vanderbilt the First, whose mansion-sized cottages dotted the island. Muncie's magazine described it in 1904 as the richest, the most exclusive, the most inaccessible club in the world. So Aldrich and Davidson chose the attendees for their expertise, but Aldrich knew their ties to Wall Street could arouse suspicion about their motives and threaten the bill's political passage. So he went to great lengths to keep the meeting secret. They're at Jekyll Island. So adopting the rules of a duck hunting trip and instructing the men to come one at a time to a train terminal in New Jersey where they could board his private train car. Once aboard, the men used only first names: Nelson, Harry, Frank, Paul, Piet, and Arthur, to prevent the staff from learning their identities. For decades after, the group referred to themselves as the First Names Club. An additional member of the First Name Club was Benjamin Strong, vice president of the Bankers Trust Company and the future founding chief executive officer, then called governor, now called president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I'm going to say that again. An additional member of the First Name Club, Benjamin Strong, vice president of the Bankers Trust Company and the future founding CEO, then called governor, now called president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. But it is unlikely Strong attended the meeting on Jekyll Island, because in his autobiography, Vanderlip recalls him attending, but no other account indicates Strong's presence. Most scholars and journalists who have written about the issue, including Bertie Charles, B.C. Forbes, the founder of Forbes magazine, and the journalist who first revealed the meeting in an article in 1916, have concluded Strong did not attend. And that's from an article in Forbes magazine from 1916. So Forbes has been around a long time. Strong had worked closely with Jekyll Island attendees in other venues, however, and his ideas were certainly present at the meeting, even if he was not there in person. After the meeting, as the First Names Club revised the plan and prepared it for publication, Strong was frequently consulted and, according to Forbes, joined the First Name Club as Ben. And that was written in a Forbes magazine article in 1922. All right, follow me now. Y'all stick with me. I'm building the foundation for all these money games. Like they say, it ain't what you make, it's what you keep. So when you ain't keeping it, I'm about to explain why and who getting it. The plan takes shape. Aldrich and his colleagues quickly realize that while they agreed on some broad principles, establishing an elastic currency supplied by a bank that held the reserves of all banks, they disagreed on details. Figuring out those details was a desperately trying undertaking, in Warburg's words. Completely secluded, the men woke up early and worked late into the night for more than a week. We had disappeared from the world into a deserted island, Vanderlip recalled in his autobiography. We put in the most intense period of work that I have ever had. By the end of their time on Jekyll Island, Aldrich and his colleagues had developed a plan for a Reserve Association of America, a single central bank with 15 branches across the country. Each branch would be governed by boards of directors elected by the members, by the member banks in each district, with the larger banks getting more votes. The branches would be responsible for holding the reserves of their member banks, issuing currency, discounting commercial paper, transferring balances between branches, and check clearing and collection. The national body would set discount rates for the system as a whole and buy and sell securities. All right, I'm going to read that whole paragraph again because that's the foundation of this whole program and the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which we're going to get into next. By the end of their time on Jekyll Island in 1910, Aldrich and his colleagues had developed a plan for a Reserve Association of America, a central bank with 15 branches across the country. Each branch would be governed by boards of directors elected by the member banks in each district, with larger banks getting more votes. The branches would be responsible for holding the reserves of their member banks, issuing currency, discounting commercial paper, transferring balances between branches, and check clearing and collection. The national body would set discount rates for the system as a whole and buy and sell securities. Okay, shortly after returning home, Aldrich became ill and was unable to write the group's final report. So Vanderlip and Strong traveled to Washington to get the plan ready for Congress. Aldrich presented it to the National Monetary Commission in January 1911. All right, now this is the National Monetary Commission in January 1911 without telling the commission members how the plan had been developed. A final report along with a legislative text went to Congress a year later with a few minor changes, including naming the new institution the National Reserve Association. In a letter accompanying the report, the commission said it had created an institution, scientific in its method, and democratic in its control. But many people, especially Democrats, objected to the version of democracy it presented, which could have allowed the largest banks to exert outsized influence on the central bank's leadership. With a presidential election coming up, the Democrats made repudiating the Aldrich plan a part of their platform. When Woodrow Wilson won the presidency and the Democrats took control of both houses, Aldrich's National Reserve Association appeared to be shelved. With that, let me take a sip of this. Hold on. Okay. Leaders of the Democratic Party, however, also were interested in reform, including President Wilson and the chairs of the House and Senate committees on banking and currency, Carter Glass and Robert Owen, respectfully. Glass and Owen both introduced proposals to form a central banking system based on draft legislation supported by Wilson. Glass, Owen, and their staffs directly consulted with Warburg, whose technical expertise was respected by Democrat and Republican politicians alike. Wilson's chief political advisor, Colonel E.M. House, met and corresponded with Warburg to discuss banking reform in general and the Glass and Owen plans in particular. So did William McAdoo and Henry Morgenthau, senior political and policy advisors to Wilson, who served in his administration. Morgenthau assured Warburg that he sent his copy of the January 10, 1913 memorandum to President Wilson. Together, these ideas formed the basis of the final Federal Reserve Act, which Congress passed and the president signed in December 1913. Remember these dates, 1913. The technical details of the final bill closely resembled those of the Aldrich plan. The major differences were the political and decision-making structures, which was a compromise acceptable to both the progressive and populist wings of the Democratic Party. All right, almost finished with this, because then we're going to jump over to the Federal Reserve Act, and I'll take any questions or comments on this. So just give me a couple more minutes. B.C. Forbes somehow learned about the Jekyll Island trip and wrote about it in 1916 in an article published in Leslie's Weekly, October 19, 1916, page 423. which was recapitulated a few months later in an article in the magazine Current Opinion. In 1917, Forbes again described the meeting in Men Who Are Making America, a collection of short biographies of prominent entrepreneurs, including Davison, Vanderlip, and Warburg. Not many people noticed the revelation, and those who did dismissed it as a mere yarn, according to Aldrich's biographer. The participants themselves denied the meeting had occurred for 20 years until the publication of Aldrich's biography in 1930. The impetus of coming clean was probably the publication in 1927 of Carter Glass' memoir, An Adventure in Constructive Finance. In it, Glass, by now a senator, claimed credit for the key ideas in the Federal Reserve Act, which prompted the Jekyll Island participants to reveal their roles in creating the Federal Reserve. Warburg was especially critical of Glass' description of events. In 1930, he published a two-volume book describing the origins of the Fed, including a line-by-line comparison of the Aldrich bill and the Glass-Owen bill to prove their similarity. In the introduction, he wrote, "I had gone to California for a 3 months rest when the appearance of a series of articles written by Senator Glass impelled me to lay down in black and white my recollections of certain events in the history of banking reform." Warburg's book does not mention Jekyll Island specifically, although he states that. "In November 1910, I was invited to join a small group of men who, at Senator Aldrich's request, were to take part in a several days conference with him to discuss the form that the new banking bill should take. When the conference closed, the rough draft of what later became the Aldrich bill had been agreed upon. The results of the conference were entirely confidential. Even the fact that there had been a meeting was not permitted to become public. Though 18 years have gone by, and I do not feel free to give a description of this most interesting conference concerning which Senator Aldrich pledged all participants to secrecy. I understand, however, a history of Senator Aldrich's life will contain an authorized account, too, of this episode." All right. So disagreements over authorship of the Federal Reserve Act received widespread publicity in the late 1920s. Glass defended his claim for the lion's share of the credit in speeches in his book and in submissions to prominent publications, including the New York Evening Post and New York Times. Critics responded in similar venues and academic journals. For example, Samuel Uttermeyer, former counsel to the House Committee on Banking and Currency, published a pamphlet titled, "Who is Entitled to the Credit for the Federal Reserve Act?" An answer to Senator Carter Glass, in which he asserted that Glass's claim of primary authorship were fiction, fable, and a work of imagination. That's what Uttermeyer wrote in 1927. In 1914, Edwin Seligman, a prominent professor at Columbia University, wrote that in its fundamental features, the Federal Reserve Act is the work of Mr. Warburg more than of any other man. In 1927, Seligman and Glass debated this point in a series of letters published in the New York Times. The Jekyll Island Club never bounced back from the Great Depression, when many of its members resigned, and it closed in 1942. Today, its former clubhouse and cottages are National Historic Landmarks, but the debates at and about the conference on Jekyll Island remain relevant today. All right, I know that was a lot, and it took almost 30 minutes, but it created the foundation for letting you know that there were six men that met, had a secret meeting on Jekyll Island to create the foundation for what we now know as the Federal Reserve Act. So the Federal Reserve Act was passed by Congress in 1913 when President Woodrow Wilson was there. And so the Federal Reserve Act was passed by the 63rd United States Congress and signed into law by President Woodrow Wilson on December 23rd, 1913. The law created the Federal Reserve System, the central banking system of the United States, which is privately owned. It's not owned by the United States. So a lot of people, I'm sure there are still people that don't know that the Federal Reserve ain't federal. So if you have any questions or like to chime in regarding any of that information that we just disclosed, feel free. Push the one on your phone, and we'll tap you in, and you can make a comment, start it. In the meantime, I am going to take a break. We're going to take a break for a little short message, come back after this message, and we will get to the meat and potatoes on this entree. So we'll be right back after these messages.
If you are in need of life insurance, auto or home insurance, or need help in getting out of debt, call your helpful insurance agents at Prime Financial Services. Did you know if you add a child rider to your life insurance policy, you can add multiple children for the price of one, starting at $10,000 worth of coverage for under $10. Call today for a free quote at 313-293-0979. Mention you heard this ad on this show for a free gift.
Is your food bland and you want to spice it up? Does it taste like something is missing? What's missing is my seasoning, Butch's Bodacious Seasoning. All-purpose seasoning, good on absolutely everything but ice cream. I'm Linda Porter, President and CEO of Butch's Bodacious Seasoning. To get the spice back in your life, call me at 313-393-2738. You won't regret it. Thank you.
We're back with Let's Talk About It with Jenny White.
All right, we're going to keep it short. We need some new commercials. But anyway, that's a whole nother subject. Where are my folks at? Where's Sister Lucy Payne and Dorothy? Where y'all at? But
Well, I have a question.
Sure.
When did they start it?
Well, 1910, November 1910 is when they had this meeting at Jekyll Island at this exclusive country club. That's when the party got started.
Was it a state or something?
Well, Jekyll Island is located in Georgia.
Okay. Okay.
So that's where they met. So they wrote up all this information to create a central banking system in the United States, which we call the Federal Reserve. And so we're going to talk about the Federal Reserve Act was passed by the 63rd United States Congress and signed into law by President Woodrow Wilson on December 23rd, 1913. The law created the federal... Huh?
No, I was just saying that's quite a few.
Well, the law created...
They had more than one, though, right, in different states.
Yeah, different banking systems, yeah, but they only... They've created the Federal Reserve Bank, which is the central bank. So everything starts from there and goes out to the other banks. So when the law created the Federal Reserve System, the central banking system of the United States, there was a panic in 1907 that convinced many Americans of the need to establish a central banking system. which the country had lacked since the Bank War of 1830s. After Democrats won unified control of Congress and the presidency in the 1912 elections, President Wilson, Congressman Carter Glass, and Senator Robert Latham Owen crafted a central banking bill that occupied a middle ground between the Aldrich Plan, which called for private control of the central banking system. Okay, that's important. I'm going to say that again. After the 1912 elections, President Wilson, Congressman Carter Glass, and Senator Robert Latham Owen crafted a central banking bill that occupied a middle ground between the Aldrich Plan, which called for a private control of the central banking system. Not a government control, but this is private. And progressives like William Jennings Bryan, who favored government control over the central banking system. Wilson made the bill a top priority for his New Freedom domestic agenda, and he helped ensure that it passed both houses of Congress without major amendments. The Federal Reserve Act created the Federal Reserve System, consisting of 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, jointly responsible for managing the country's money supply. The Federal Reserve Act created the Federal Reserve System, consisting of 12 regional Federal Reserve banks jointly responsible for managing the country's money supply, making loans, and providing oversight to banks and serving as a lender of last resort. To lead the Federal Reserve System, the Act established the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, members of which are appointed by the president. The 1933 Banking Act amended the Federal Reserve Act to create the Federal Open Market Committee, which oversees the Federal Reserve's open market operations. A later amendment requires the Federal Reserve to promote effectively the goals of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. Overview. The Federal Reserve Act created a system of private and public entities. There were to be at least 8 and no more than 12 private regional Federal Reserve banks. 12 were established. And each had a various branch, a board of directors, and district boundaries. The Federal Reserve Board, consisted of 7 members, was created as the governing board of the Fed. Each member is appointed by the U.S. President and confirmed by the U.S. Senate. In 1935, the board was renamed and restructured. Also created as part of the Federal Reserve System was a 12-member Federal Advisory Committee and a single new United States currency, the Federal Reserve Note. The Federal Reserve Act created a national currency and a monetary system that could respond effectively to the stresses in the banking system and create a stable financial system. With the goal of creating a national monetary system and financial stability, the Federal Reserve Act also provided many other functions and financial services for the economy, such as check clearing and collection for all members of the Federal Reserve. With the passing of the Federal Reserve Act, Congress required that all nationally chartered banks become members of the Federal Reserve System. These banks were required to purchase specified non-transferable stock in their regional Federal Reserve Bank and set aside a stipulated amount of non-interest-bearing reserves with their respective reserve banks. So since 1980, all depository institutions have been required to set aside reserves with the Federal Reserve. Such institutions are entitled to certain Federal Reserve services. State chartered banks were given the option of becoming members of the Federal Reserve System, and in the case of the exercise of such option, were to be subject to supervision in part by the Federal Reserve System. Member banks became entitled to have access to discounted loans at the discount window in their respective reserve banks to a 6% annual dividend in their Federal Reserve stock and to other services. So give you a little background. Central banking has made various institutional appearances throughout the history of the United States. These institutions started with the first and second banks of the United States, which were championed in large part by Alexander Hamilton, first Secretary of Treasury of the United States.
All right. Well, let me ask you, when they started those banks, was it for people were able to borrow, or were they just putting their money in at first, and they couldn't use? Yeah, I mean, they're not asking to borrow. They're just putting their money in. How did that work?
Well, it seems that at first, people were able to make deposits, and it seemed like a lot of the loans were going to a lot of the larger cities or larger institutions or companies because they weren't able to open banks outside of the country, so they were limited to their span of services. Now, the first bank of the United States, the American financial system was deeply fragmented after the American Revolutionary War. The government was burdened with large wartime debts, and the new republic needed a strong financial institution to give the country a resilient financial footing. So Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson had opposing views regarding whether or not the U.S. could benefit from a European-style national financial institution. Alexander Hamilton was in favor of building a strong centralized political and economic institution to solve the country's financial problem. He argued that a central bank could bring order to the U.S. monetary system, manage the government revenues and payments, and provide credit to both the public and private sectors. On the other hand, Thomas Jefferson was deeply suspicious of a central bank because he argued it would undermine democracy. Jefferson and Southern members of Congress also believed that a strong central financial institution would serve commercial interests of the North at the expense of Southern-based agricultural interests whose credit was provided by local banks during post-Revolutionary War era. So the first Bank of the United States was established in 1791. It was chartered for a period of 20 years. The U.S. government was the largest shareholder of the bank. Despite its shareholder status, the government was not permitted to participate in management of the bank. The bank accepted deposits, issued banknotes, and provided short-term loans to the government. It also functioned as a clearinghouse for government debt. The bank could also regulate state-chartered banks to prevent overproduction of banknotes. The bank was very successful in financing the government and stimulating the economy. In spite of its successes, hostility against the bank did not fade. Jeffersonians questioned the bank's constitutionality. And so in 1811, the First Bank of the United States failed to be renewed by one vote in both the House and the Senate. So this is just giving you a little history about what's going on in the United States.
So they did let them borrow some money.
Yeah, they were they lent it out some money, you know, public and private, and they also regulated the state chartered banks to prevent overproduction of banknotes. And they said that they were very successful in financing the government and stimulating the economy. But you had these two people that were on different sides, Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. And Jefferson questioned the bank's constitutionality. So in 1811, First Bank of the United States failed to get renewed by one vote in the House and the Senate. So they started a second bank of the United States after the War of 1812. So economic instability necessitated the creation of a second national bank. It got a little crazy in the United States. Economic instability necessitated the creation of a second national bank. Due to expanding money supply and lack of supervision, individual bank activity sparked high inflation. So in 1816, a second national bank was created with a charter of 20 years. 3 years later, during the Panic of 1819, the Second Bank of the United States was blamed for overextending credit in a land boom. People were buying up a bunch of land and would tighten up credit policies following the panic. The second bank was unpopular. I mean, I don't know. Too bad. There wasn't a whole lot of black people able to purchase land in 1819. The second bank was unpopular among the Western and Southern state chartered banks, and constitutionality of a national bank was questioned. So President Andrew Jackson would come into office and wish to end the current central bank under the premise that the bank favored a small economic and political elite at the expense of the public majority. The second bank became private after its charter expired in 1836 and would undergo liquidation in 1841. So for nearly 80 years, the United States was without a central bank. After the charter of the Second Bank of the United States was allowed to expire. So after various financial panics, particularly a severe one in 1907, some Americans became persuaded that the country needed some sort of banking and currency reform that when threatened by financial panics, provided a ready reserve of liquid assets and furthermore allow for currency and credit to expand and contract seasonally within the United States economy. Okay. So some of this was chronicled in the reports of the National Monetary Commission during 1909-1912, which was created by the Aldrich-Vreeland Act in 1908. Follow me for a minute. Included in a report of the commission submitted to Congress January 9, 1912, were recommendations and draft legislation with 59 sections for proposed changes in U.S. banking and currency laws. The proposed legislation was known as the Aldrich Plan, named after the chairman of the commission, Republican Senator Nelson W. Aldrich of Rhode Island. All right, so this time is going by pretty fast. So let me go from here, just to give you the foundation of the Federal Reserve System. We've talked about the meeting at Jekyll Island in November 1910, and just at that point, the dollar was based on gold. So what we're going to talk about right quick now is how is anyone familiar with petrodollars? Has anyone heard of petrodollars?
No.
No. All right. Well, petrodollars is not a currency. It's simply U.S. dollars that have been exchanged for crude oil exports. The term rose to economic and political prominence in the mid-1970s amid growing independence between the U.S. and crude oil exporters. Foreign oil exporters' reliance on the U.S. dollar as the principal means of exchange and store of value reflected the dollar's already established role as the global reserve currency, which continues without serious challenge to this day. Well, it's being challenged now by BRICS, B-R-I-C-S. But the dollar had been based on the United States, the financial system had been based on gold, but Nixon changed it to oil. So the United States currency is based on oil. So anybody that purchases oil from Saudi Arabia, countries like that, has to purchase it with American dollars. So the dollar's global stature and wide use stem from the U.S. economy's leading global role and its openness to foreign trade and investment. These advantages prove irresistible to oil exporters, and their reliance on the dollar in turn extended its dominance. So key takeaways, petrodollars are dollars paid to oil-producing countries for their exports. Anybody that buys oil got to use American money, got to use U.S. dollars. The petrodollar emerged as an economic concept in the 1970s as growing U.S. imports of increasingly costly crude oil increased the dollar holding of foreign producers. Petrodollar recycling is the reinvestment of crude oil export revenue denominated in dollars. The dollar status as the leading global currency preceded petrodollars' rise and has continued amid increased U.S. production and widening current account deficits. The Bretton Woods rise of the petrodollar. The Bretton Woods system of fixed currency exchange rates tied to gold through the U.S. dollar collapsed in 1971. Because the global economy and its demand for safe assets outgrew the available supply of bullion. All right, so the global economy and its demand for safe assets outgrew the available supply of gold. So only the dollar could realistically fill that void. I mean, you can print as much paper as you want. And as the global supply of dollars grew amid U.S. trade and budget deficits, so did the accumulation of petrodollars earned by oil exporters benefiting from sharply higher crude oil prices. Exporters accepted dollars because they had no alternative. It was the currency of their leading customer, and even more importantly, the currency of international trade and finance. So growing mutual dependence led to deals between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, setting the terms for the reinvestment of Saudi petrodollars in U.S. treasuries in 1974 and for U.S.-run development projects in Saudi Arabia in 1979. So the development of oil and gas reserves outside the Middle East starting in the late 1970s eventually spread the petrodollars around to new exporters like Norway, whose sovereign wealth fund was worth $1.4 trillion at the end of 2021 and held nearly 1.5% of all publicly listed global equities. All right, so that's what the petrodollar is. It's the American dollar is based on oil reserves as opposed to it being based on gold. So we've talked about the Federal Reserve. We talked about these central banks who conduct monetary policy by adjusting the supply of money, usually through buying or selling securities in the open market. Okay. So we've got these high interest rates right now that are just ridiculous. So let's talk about taxes and how that fits in. A brief history of taxes in the U.S. Taxes in the U.S. didn't always exist as they do today. America's first citizens were subject to very few taxes. But as time went on, more levies were added, federal income tax, the alternative minimum tax, corporate tax, estate tax, Federal Insurance Contributions Act, FICA taxes, and so on. Some were increased while others were repealed, only to be added again. So I'll read an analysis of the origins of some of the more common taxes U.S. residents face today. The Constitution gave Congress the power to impose taxes and other levies on the general public. Through the Civil War, though the Civil War led to the creation of the first income tax in the U.S., the federal income tax as we know it now was officially enacted in 1913. That's when they created the Federal Reserve System, the Federal Reserve Act. Many of the taxes we pay today were created in the 1920s and the 1930s, including the estate tax, gift tax, and Social Security taxes. It's used to apply to everyone based on income, regardless of status, single, married, heads of household. All right, check this out. America become before income taxes. Taxes have been around for thousands of years, especially income taxes. But that wasn't always the case in the United States. The country was income tax free in its infancy. That's because there was no federal government to establish one. The British government, however, imposed a variety of taxes on the colonists. These included a head tax, real estate taxes, and the infamous tea tax that led to the Boston Tea Party. So after the Revolutionary War, the Constitution gave Congress the power to impose taxes and other levies on the general public. States were responsible for collecting and passing them on the federal government. Most of these were excise taxes, taxes imposed on specific goods or services, such as alcohol and tobacco. The government also tried direct taxation, taxing things an individual owned that didn't last, and the feds went back to collecting excise taxes. Income taxes. The Civil War led to the creation of the country's first income tax and the first version of the Office of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, the earlier version of what we now call the IRS, Internal Revenue Service. This office took over from individual states the responsibility of collecting federal taxes. Excise taxes were also added to almost every commodity possible, alcohol, tobacco, gunpowder, tea. The IRS is also a private entity as well. The federal income tax, as we know it, was officially enacted in 1913 with the Federal Reserve Act. Corporate income taxes were enacted slightly earlier in 1909. Income tax rates then and now. Tax rates tend to change often, but not always, rising. When the federal income tax was implemented to help finance World War I in 1913, for example, the marginal tax rate was 1%. On income from 0 to 20,000, 2% on income from 20 to 50,000, 3% on income from 50 to 75, 4% on income 75 to 100 grand, 5% on income from 100,000 to 250, 6% on income from 250 to 550, and 7% on income of 500,000 and up. Tax rates were the same for everyone who filed taxes, and there was no filing status. This meant all taxpayers paid the same rate, whether they were single, married, heads of households. That changed over time. Tax rates increased considerably, then dropped, with the highest marginal tax rate settling at 37% as of 2023. The highest U.S. marginal tax ever was 94% in 1944. They're taking 94 cents out of your dollar in 1945 to finance World War II. Modern tax rates also depend on financial status. The federal government created numerous other taxes over the years, including state tax, gift tax, Social Security tax, alternative minimum tax, corporate alternative minimum tax. All right, so the first estate tax was enacted in 1797 in order to fund the U.S. Navy. It was repealed but reinstituted over the years. The modern estate tax, we know it was implemented in 1916. Multiple taxes were created in the 20s and 30s, and the gift tax coming in 1924. President Franklin Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act in 1935. The government first collected Social Security taxes in January 1937, although no benefits were paid until January 1940. The alternative minimum tax, AMT, a type of federal income tax, wasn't enacted until 78. This parallel system uses a separate set of rules to calculate taxable income after allowed deductions. It is designed to prevent higher income taxpayers from avoiding their fair share of taxes. Yeah, good luck with that. In 2022, Congress passed a corporate alternative minimum tax, CAMT, starting in 2023. It applies to corporations with average annual adjusted book income over $1 billion for a period of three consecutive years. They've got sales taxes, which have been imposed by the states, not the federal government. First sales tax was enacted in West Virginia in 1921. 11 other states followed suit in 1933. By 1940, 18 more states had a sales tax in place. Alaska, Delaware, Montana, New Hampshire, and Oregon are the only states without a sales tax. So only states that don't have sales tax, in case you're looking to move, is Alaska, Delaware, Montana, New Hampshire, and Oregon. That's why a lot of people start their businesses in Delaware. Sin taxes. Federal tobacco taxes were first enacted in 1794, but came and went over the years until 1864. That year, a box of 20 cigarettes was taxed at 8 cents. The rate is a dollar per pack in 2023. Now they're taxing it. So, you know, they've got spirit, wine, and beers are each taxed at different rates by federal and state governments. It's just crazy. Gasoline taxes, investment taxes, income taxes. It's just a bunch of taxes. All right. Let me see. Anybody want to? I've been doing a lot of talking. But it's a lot of information. I think we're going to have to come back and go back over some of this. But America instituted the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. Amendment 16 to the Constitution was ratified on February 3rd, 1913. It grants Congress the authority to issue an income tax without having to determine it based on population. The official text is written as such: the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, we don't care where you get your money, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. In the Constitution's original writing, the taxing clause in Article 1 grants Congress the general authority to lay and collect taxes, duties, imports, and excises. For direct taxes, Article 1 commands that they must be collected based on the population of the states. Before an income tax was established, the majority of funds given to the federal government derived from tariffs on domestic and international goods. The Short-Lived Revenue Act of 1861 predated the 16th Amendment as the first official federal income tax, but it was eventually repealed in 1872 during Reconstruction. So that's it in a nutshell, just to let you know where your money's going and how it started. And it's a whole nother show of good information where we can talk about these central banks and how they're forecasting these high interest rates, which are right now ridiculous. If you are looking to purchase a house or a car, you'll see these rates are just outrageous. I got a quote on some auto insurance today. You know, my auto insurance went up with AAA, so I said, let me go and start pricing this out. I called State Farm today, and for two cars, pleasure vehicles, these cars ain't even going to work. They was talking about $1,500 a month. I couldn't believe it.
What are they doing?
I got
overcharging. Overcharging.
Super overcharging. I got a quote on two cars, and they wanted to charge $1,500 a month. I was like, y'all on dope at State Farm. y'all tripping. I couldn't believe the lady said that with a straight face over the phone.
What was the year?
Sound like she had a straight face over the phone.
What was the year, though, of the car?
Both vehicles over 10 years old.
Huh?
I got a quote on two vehicles over 10 years old. And they were trying to charge me $1,500 a month.
That's crazy.
Oh, it's beyond crazy.
Are they cars that you could drive in the Dream Cruise?
No, they're not classic. I got another insurance company for that.
Okay, because I was about to say I was going to hook you up with somebody on that.
Yeah, I use Hagerty for the 63.
Okay.
But for the other two, I couldn't believe it. I'm like, huh? And these are pleasure. They rated as pleasure, and for the minimum state allowed of $50,000 coverage, that was $1,400. So, you know, so it was just ridiculous. I'm like, oh, my God. So, I mean, everything's going up. You know, they're trying to find ways
to take
more of your money any way they can. They've been running articles on TV the past couple of days about how expensive fast food is now. And they're saying, you know, with this minimum wage being increased, you know, so is your fast food. So, you know, ain't nobody money going up, but all your expenses are. So it is ridiculous. So, you know, I just wanted to kind of give you guys an idea of the money game and how it started with the meeting at Jekyll Island in 1910. And then with the passing of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, and we didn't even get into the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, which is a whole another animal, international, you know.
They started all of this on a island that was basically black people, because that's right there by Florida, Jekyll Island, and that's where the Geechies are.
Check that out. Now, any black people that was on that island were working as domestics, because they had, you know, the Rockefeller. well, they didn't even say Rockefeller, but they had Vanderbilt and a few other people they named had mansions on the island. So they had some big money over there. So I'm sure there was some black people on the island. They were just working for the white people.
It initially was nothing but black people on the island. And when the white people start moving in, that's when the Gula language came in. They made up their own language so that the white people couldn't understand what they were saying.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that sounds familiar. We had to do that on a few occasions.
Yeah. That's where Pig Latin came in.
Okay.
And that's not far from Savannah. And
no,
right on the borderline of Florida.
All right. Yeah, you're right about that. So the game has been put into place on how to get our money by any means necessary. And if you don't understand how the game is played, you just play into it. And that's just like the income taxes. They say you pay income taxes. It ain't going to the feds to pay for the running of the government. They say that's your income taxes is going towards paying the interest on the loan that the government is taking out from the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where your income taxes is going. The government gets, is taking loans from the Federal Reserve, the private agencies, the private banking system, and your income taxes going to pay the interest on that. So, there's a trend.
Money game.
Oh my God, it's a money game. I mean, you have to understand. And they ain't teaching it to you. They ain't teaching none of this in college.
They didn't teach it in grade school. Okay,
they teaching you how to be an employee.
That's the truth.
Yeah, so you can keep working for the system and keep, making these rich people wealthy. That's just like Rockefeller. They say that Rockefeller, has seven generations of relatives that are living off of his wealth because of the systems that were put in place, and that the Vanderbilts, have spent all their money because they didn't have the same systems. They spent all the principal. So, black people aren't taught this. And if you were fortunate enough to have a relative who was astute enough to who maybe understood and was maybe able to get some land, and some things like that, then good for you. But most of us, is every man for himself. And every generation has to start from scratch. Everybody start from zero. Your parents, ain't leave you nothing, so you starting from scratch, from zero. And if you don't leave nothing to your kids, you don't have any insurance when you die. So your kids starting from, whatever they can generate. So there's no generational wealth being generated. Now, what'd you say?
I think now is the time that black people are really starting to understand that.
Yeah, it's more that are understanding it more now. The conversation is out there.
Right.
Conversations out there, but you can still lead a horse to water, and they still, they A lot of people just ain't going for it, even though the information is there. Like they say, you know, if you want to hide something from a black person, put it in a book.
That's what they say.
Well, so we have to, you know, make our money. I heard something that says that, you know, the other communities live off their money and 98% of ours. So that's why they so that's why they so afraid of us, you know, organizing and establishing, because then, you know, we're gonna take away their second income. You know, if we were to start spending our money in our community and have our money cycling more than one time, if it cycles that much. So we got a long way to go. You know, we've got a long way to go. We got a lot of things that have been, a lot of systems put in place to delay us organizing and becoming wealthy. I mean, you know, they've gone out of their way to destroy our Black Wall Streets and, you know, our towns, and lynch the people that have become successful and didn't feel like they had to kiss the white people's butts. You know, they couldn't wait to kill them. You know,
and that's
the
truth. You speak up too loud, you end up dead.
Oh, man, they couldn't wait. And then try to take your stuff, you know, and run you off your land and then take your land. You know, I read an article about a man, and I'll have to get the details. I can't remember exactly where he lived, but he had done very well for himself, you know, had a bunch of acres, you know, and lived in the town, and he would, you know, harvest his crop and take it to the, you know, take it in town, and you know, they would negotiate a rate and they would pay him. So this particular time he went, had his, you know, supply, and the white man lowballed him. So I guess they had words, you know, and white people wasn't used to black people talking back to him. So the white man had his worker hit the black man upside the head with an axe handle, you know, so he bust the man's head, you know. So I think the black man shot the owner or something. So at this point, you know, they got that mob mentality. So, you know, they went and told the sheriff, and, you know, they got this mob of people that came looking for the man. So he ran, and I think he ran out into the woods in a barn or somewhere, and, you know, they confronted him, and he was able to, he injured somebody, but they had injured him again. And so the sheriff ended up arresting him and taking him to jail to save his life. I think it was probably over 200 people, 200 white people trying to kill him. So they took him to jail, and this is a rich black man. So, you know, it's a rich nigga. So they ended up overtaking the sheriff at the jail and got the black man out, and, you know, they ended up dragging the rich black man around town. So at some point he was dead. Then they hung his body up, and then they riddled him with bullets, you know. Then after that, I think he had about 12 kids that stayed on his land. You know, he had about 12 kids. They had built houses on the property, and, you know, everybody staying there. And they ran the kids off. I think this was North Carolina. It's starting to come back to me. So they ended up running the kids off. They, you know, they gave, the kids ended up negotiating. I think they gave them maybe, they might have gave them a week. 6 days or something. They gave him a short period of time to leave. And so they ended up leaving, and then they ended up wholesaling all his property. I think he had over 1,000 acres. He ended up, you know, selling his property for pennies on the dollar to some white man who bought it. And, you know, his family didn't get nothing from that. But all that generational wealth was just taken. And that's just one person. One story.
Now, I just recently read an article about, I can't remember what state it was, and it might be who you're talking about, where the family went and got an attorney, and they got their land back.
Wow.
They just recently got all their land back, and there's some, wherever it is, it's near a beach, and the hotel, some hotel chain was getting ready to break ground or buy the land or something, and now they can't do it because the state gave them their land, gave the family their land back, and they're very upset about it.
There is a documentary about a family that I saw whose relative had purchased the land in 1800s. And, you know, they ended up locking up a couple of the brothers, you know, the family had it. They owned the beach, you know, so I know exactly what you're talking about. And, you know, and a lot of people said during that time of growing up, you know, this is one of the few places where black people could go and, you know, and not be intimidated by white people, you know, just a bunch of black people at the beach having fun, a bunch of kids, ain't no problems, you know, ain't no problem from the white people. But then they ended up locking up two of the brothers for some years over some trumped up charges because they wouldn't sign over the property. One of the relatives stayed, I think, in New York. No, this was in Carolina. And, you know, he tried to state his claim to the property and ended up selling a portion of the beachfront property to a company. So similar to the same story that you're talking about, Dorothy. And but there were still other acres, and they were just harassing the family. And I'm trying to see if I can, I've got it here somewhere, but.
Well, you really don't have the time.
Yeah, we got about 5 minutes left. We don't normally talk this long, but we had a good show, a lot of information.
And,
yes.
And you didn't finish it, so can we do this next week?
Yeah, we can finish it next week. We'll talk about the International Monetary Fund, which is running things over in Africa and all over the world, and, you know, just talk about how they're controlling these funds and finances and keeping these, you know, some of these countries enslaved. And they're talking about how they got to keep Africa from becoming like Norway, because I guess they've got oil in Norway, and Norway became independent in the 60s. And, you know, just a very wealthy country. They say the people that, you know, graduate from college there, they don't leave. They, you know, they got everything they want in Norway, and they just need to prevent Africa from becoming the same way. Becoming independent. They need to keep Africa poor, at least the people in Africa, while they continue to raid and steal the resources. So, yep. So that is it. I appreciate everybody for tuning in and participating. And any final words from anybody? Jenny White, you have any final words?
One day, you will wake up and there won't be any more time to do the things you've always wanted. Do it now.
Well, that's real. I mean, most of us have more days behind us than we do ahead of us. So
that's it.
So I understand. Well, thank you, Hostess with the Mostess. It's been real. We talked about the meeting at Jekyll Island, and we'll continue this conversation next week talking about the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and some of these countries like Britain, Russia, India, South Africa, and China, how they're, you know, working to create their own currency and have it backed by gold as opposed to oil. And with those things being threatening the American dollar and the dollar just losing its value will really put the American people in a world of hurt. So we'll continue to connect the dots, kind of see where we are currently in the world. And like you say, you lead people to water. So, you know, we'll inform you. And you do what you need to do with your 401k plans and your investments. And because I do believe that there is going to come a time in the near future where they're going to, like in 2008, when the banking system and the real estate system, you know, crashed, they're going to steal people's money again. You know, where all your money is going to disappear, all your savings in the stocks and bonds, and it just doesn't disappear. Somebody gets that money. So it's coming. So everybody, it's TGIF. Enjoy your weekend. I think I'm going to try to do some bowling this weekend. I've been wanting to bowl for the past month. I think I'm going to do it this weekend. And I think that will be my weekend of excitement.
Well, I'm going to tell you like my mother used to tell me, don't put off for tomorrow what you can do today.
No, that's right. So I'm going to make it happen. So I'm going to take another.
Well, I think I'm going to be right behind you.
All right.
Okay, well, everybody have a wonderful evening. Miss Margaret, as soon as this program is over, please give me a call.
Right.
Did you hear that, Margaret? Don't be laughing.
All right, y'all.